Welcome to episode 23 of About Nashville. I'm Mike Rogers. Thank you, everybody, for listening to my podcast. Today's guest is Tommy Emmanuel. He is a guitar virtuoso, recording artist, CMA winner, Grammy nominee, and international star. We talked about how he learned to play guitar in Australia, how Chet Atkins became his mentor, and how he mentored Keith Urban. Well, we also talked about Johnny Cash's mystical it factor and how Paul McCartney recruited him, or tried to recruit him, to teach his musical school in Liverpool. It was a fantastic talk here in Nashville with this musical legend. So did you watch the Wilder-Areola fight, Holly?
I did not.
The heavyweight championship.
I did not. I should be ashamed of myself.
You should. You want to hear something funny?
Yes.
So I'm watching this fight, and guess who one of the judges was?
Oh, my gosh, who?
David Hudson, the guest from last episode.
Oh, wow, really?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Wow, that's exciting. Yeah, that's exciting.
I thought that was like, wait a minute. I just had him on the show last episode. David Hudson was one of the judges for the Deontay Wilder-Chris Areola Heavyweight Championship of the World, which Wilder retained his title, I believe, with an eighth-round TKO. So it's like, okay, this is pretty cool. Boy, this is going to be a crazy, crazy week for me. This is what I call my birthday hell week.
Why?
It is, because everybody's birthday, except for me and Presley's, is this week.
Really?
My wife's was Saturday.
Happy birthday.
I know. So I took her to cinema. I don't know if you've ever been to cinema.
I have, and I love it.
Isn't it great?
It's awesome.
So what do you love about it?
Everything. I love the scenery. You know, I like to date in, well, not like to, but they have little secluded areas in the back where you can, you know, kind of drink and touch and all that.
Okay. I thought it was kind of crazy. We went in there and we went to the bar.
It's a little sexy.
It was very sexy.
Yeah.
That was a very sexy kind of atmosphere, you know. I sat there in my boxer shorts and my sweet tea.
Is Jennifer pregnant?
No.
Okay,
no,
good.
No. Actually, if she's pregnant, it ain't mine.
Hey, watch it now.
So we celebrated her birthday. And then my daughter's is Tuesday. She will be six.
Oh, wow.
So for her birthday, we went and got her a trampoline.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
That trampoline about killed me. I worked on it all day yesterday. I was in the heat for 8 hours. I look like a cooked piece of bacon right now. I mean, I'm burnt in places I didn't even know I had places.
Crispy.
I'm crispy. And, so I finally got the dadgum trampoline up. It was nightfall. It was dark by the time the whole thing was finally up. And, you know, like people were coming out like, you still working on that thing?
Of course.
Yeah, I'm
of
still
course.
Working on this. My daughter is expecting it to be ready.
That's right. She deserves it.
She does.
She
and
does.
I got it up in line. And so she's all excited about that. Now, my son, his birthday's on Thursday.
Damn.
He's going to be 18 years old.
That's right. Our kids share the same birthday.
Is that not crazy?
I know. That's right. Not weak. Just girls are always hell when they get to a certain age. Uh-huh. And she's 19. Uh-huh. But she's still, like, really, really spoiled. Mm-hmm. And so much of a diva.
Okay.
So, like, the whole month has been revolving around her.
Well, she's unlike her mother how?
I didn't care about stuff like that.
Oh, you
I just didn't.
Lie.
I didn't. I was more of a tomboy, so it didn't. That stuff didn't matter to me.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't believe that, but
believe it.
So, what are y'all gonna do for her birthday?
Nothing.
What?
Absolutely nothing.
Why?
I'm gonna get her a cake. I might take her out to dinner. It's time for her to date. That's not my focus anymore.
You don't even let her drive.
Oh, whatever. He better have a car.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Exactly.
Your face turned. You're as red as my back.
Crispy.
I'm telling you. So now I've got my wife's best friend's child's birthday was 2 days before my daughter's. So we have her birthday. We have Berkeley's birthday. We have my wife's birthday. We have my daughter's birthday, my son's birthday, and now we have your daughter's birthday.
That's right.
Are there any other birthdays that I don't know about?
Nope.
This is going to be a rough, rough week.
No, it's fun.
It is. I don't like celebrating anything. So anyway, it is what it is. So what are y'all going to do for your fireworks?
Nothing.
Nothing, really?
Absolutely nothing.
Why? Because she can't drive there?
No, because she's going to listen. And if I surprise her with anything, she'll know. So we're not doing anything.
Okay. So, by the way, I'm trying to, I know you're listening to this show right now, so I'm just saying, Lord. I'm sitting here advocating for you, for your mother to at least give you a gift or give you something, for her for your birthday. But she's adamant about that.
Nothing. That's right.
So what advice would you give her for her birthday? Because you're telling her right now.
Don't have any. Get a boyfriend with a car.
So your advice, your birthday advice to her is get a boyfriend with a car.
Mm-hmm. So he can take her
bad
on a date.
Bad things happen with boys with cars.
Oh, they do. Sorry. Choke me.
Explicit rating, but,
kill me.
Yes, bad things happen with boys and cars.
They do. All right.
So that's what you
do. No, I'm not. I take it back. I retract that statement. Everything I said about it.
Okay. So what other kind of wisdom do you give her?
I don't have any more. I'm scared to say anything.
I'm scared for you to say anything after that little outburst.
You know how I am. I have no filter. I'm sorry. I'll work on it, I promise. Not this week, though.
Okay. Well, if you were a cigarette, you'd be left-handed, so...
I'm a knockout fighter with a kick-ass band. That's why they call me the Honky Tonk Hitman. A knockout fighter with a kick-ass band. That's why they call me the Honky Tonk Hitman. Yeah.
Welcome to About Nashville with your host, the Honky Tonk Hitman, Mike Rogers.
Hello. Good morning, America. How are you? Don't you know me? I'm your native son.
Yeah. I saw somewhere that you sang, but I didn't realize that.
Oh, just I can sing well enough to get by.
Okay.
In my shows, I sing a couple of Merle Travis tunes, mm-hmm. and because I play that style,
mm-hmm.
and then. In the second part of the show, just when people think they've kind of seen everything, I launch into "I Hurt Myself Today."
Okay. Yeah. So you do the Johnny Cash where he remade the
It was Nine Inch Nails.
Okay.
It's a Trent Reznor song.
Okay.
And I sing it sort of halfway between the original and Johnny Cash's, kind of my way of doing it.
Okay.
And it's just a great opportunity to let the dark side speak.
Yeah, you know,
because that's what that song's about,
uh-huh.
about being a junkie and all that. Not that I've ever been a junkie, but I've been around people who were heroin addicts, and I saw what they were going through. And,
right.
and I've met quite a few who would look you in the eye and say, "Don't trust me."
Mm-hmm.
I'll do whatever I can to get what I need, including screwing you over, And that's what that song's about. What have I become, my sweetest friend? Everyone I know goes away in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have it all, my empire of dirt.
Mm-hmm.
I will let you down. I will make you hurt. And it's just so powerful.
It is. It is a very, very powerful song. And to think that was, Johnny's last video with June.
Yeah,
when you're watching it, it is so dark. And to think that they did go through that world.
Exactly. But also the video is he's really bearing his soul but he's portraying this song, you know, when he says, my empire of dirt, and it says the house of cash, and they're all the awards are all kind of all dusty and got, you know what I mean? It's
very
like
poetic.
Yeah, it's like all that stuff there doesn't mean anything.
Right.
You know, only what's in your heart is what will last. Everything else, all everything else is just scenery, and it will rot away in time.
Right.
But, you know, what you hand on to your children and to other people is what lasts.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
Mm.
So,
well, that's just my interpretation of that.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a great interpretation, and I mean, that song resonated with so many people.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
It wasn't even just the people that have experienced that world. It's just the people that, I don't know, I think Johnny, there was something about the way Johnny conveyed the song, conveyed the lyrics in the song, conveyed the pain in the song.
Oh, absolutely. Well, he can relate to everything. He's done everything.
And true.
You know?
Yeah.
And, but, you know, he was a guy with a otherworldly charisma, and I witnessed it myself several times. And yeah, I don't know whether you've ever been around somebody who, when they walk out in front of the public, people almost fall to the ground.
Wow.
They break into they cry and wail just because that person's standing there, and whoa, you've never seen anything like it. That happened to me when I was in San Francisco. I went to see the Highwaymen back in 95.
Okay.
And the other three guys, I love them and respect them so much, you know, mm-hmm. Chris Christopherson, Willie Nelson, and of course Waylon Jennings, and they were so great. But when Johnny Cash walked out, the others may as well have stayed home because everybody started screaming, and this is like 30,000 people at this stadium. People were screaming and yelling, and some people were just crying.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself with tears in my eyes, and I looked around me, and everybody I could see were crying. And he was just standing there. He wasn't doing anything.
Right.
He was just standing there. And then he walked to the microphone and went to lean in, and the crowd took off again. So he backed off. And then he lifted his guitar up and played a bit, and then it came in again. And then when he got his face close to the microphone, he waited and waited, and the crowd finally died down. And then he went, get rhythm. And we all just about died, you know? And after the show, I was driving back to my apartment, and I thought, what was that? What is it that guy has that we just see him and we feel the power of the universe somehow,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it nearly kills us. It knocks us over.
Yeah.
And
the Beatles had it.
Exactly.
Elvis had it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Muhammad Ali had it.
Muhammad Ali had it, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a powerful thing.
It is.
It's a powerful, powerful thing. And, you know, it's got to be respect and admiration and all that kind of stuff, but there's something undeniable about that. We all know what he went through and all that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
but there was something so deep and real about that guy,
right.
And that's what we're drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if I could put it to words, the truth is irresistible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, I'm one of the luckiest people on earth, because I get to make a living and travel around the world playing music, and all I'm doing is being myself. I'm not doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to keep it that way, that I just do what I think I'm getting better at all the time,
mm-hmm.
and that I try to give it my everything every show. And I think that's what people come back for, and that's what people are looking for, something real.
Right.
And, you know, you just can't buy that. You got to live it. You know, there was a great saxophone player named Charlie Parker who revolutionized jazz music.
Mm.
And he lived a hard life, but everything he played was so deep. And he said one time, if you don't live it, it won't come out your horn.
Oh.
You know, so if we don't live the way we're supposed to live and be honest,
mm-hmm.
You're not going to get that across to people.
Sure.
And that's why a guy like Johnny Cash can just stand there and say, this, he's totally bare.
Right.
Know? And actually, I tell people a lot, especially young people who want to do what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. They want to play the guitar and entertain people and be in the happiness business, you know, because that's what it is. I play music, you get happy. That's what matters, you know. There's nothing else. There's no other reason. And that's why it works.
Okay.
You know, I don't want to be rich and famous. I just want to play well
right. And
do my job. And that's my only motivation. I don't let any of the other stuff get in the way,
uh-huh. You
know. My focus is on trying to be a better player today than I was yesterday. That's all. And to provide for my family and do something good on this planet. And people who want to do what I'm doing, I tell them, well, okay, what you got to come to terms with is that when I go out there, I may as well be naked because everything is exposed. There's nowhere to hide. In other words, what I do has to be, every part of it has to be honest, it has to be open, and it has to be right.
Uh-huh.
My sound has to be right, my tuning has to be right, my playing, my arrangements, my everything, and most importantly, my reasons for doing it have to be right.
Right.
Because everything is on display. And if all those elements come together, then it's nature's way that it'll come over you like a tidal wave.
Would you say you're a perfectionist?
I try to be. I mean, meaning I'm always shooting for the highest that I possibly can.
Uh-huh.
But there are days, this is another thing that you have to come to terms with, not only as a person, but as an artist especially, is that you're going to have days where you don't come up to what you expect, and you try, and it just doesn't flow the way you know it can. Mm-hmm. Because when you have those days where you go out there and the magic just happens and your ideas flow, and then it's like, oh my God, this is so great, you know, mm-hmm. and you're feeling great, you're playing, your ideas are flowing, you know, they're dangerous times because you're not going to get that every time, but that's what you want.
I have watched hours and hours of you live and also listened to hours and hours of your music. So my question to you is, have you ever had have you ever had a time when you flopped?
I've never flopped, but I've had better days than others.
Okay, because you know? I mean, it's like you're electric. Whenever you go out there and you just touch that guitar and you go into your show,
mm-hmm.
the place just goes nuts, absolutely nuts.
Well, you got to work your way. You got to earn that kind of respect from people, and it's also a matter of, like, if you're going to go out there, then you got to be prepared to give people everything.
Right, right.
You know, don't go out there and hold back or, you know, be Mr. Cool. Get out there and give those people everything you can,
mm-hmm.
then take a rest and do it again the next day.
Are you completely spent when a show's done?
Totally.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I have no brain left after the show. It's true, Mike. It takes a lot of brain power
mm-hmm.
to play complicated stuff on the guitar and to be in the moment and flying your musical kite to see where you can take it, because that's all part of my show,
mm-hmm.
is the fact that I've got certain songs that I play that people know, and I try to interpret them as I wrote them,
mm-hmm.
and I don't mess with them. But then there are other songs that I specifically have in the show where I just go off into improvisation,
mm-hmm.
and that's when you're looking for that magic carpet ride,
sure.
and you try to get your ideas flowing, and that's you digging for something good,
sure.
You know, and people want to see that just as much. They want to see you trying as hard as you can.
Absolutely.
You know,
you're one of my top five, absolutely in my top five best guitarists of all time. My question to you though is your style is like Bruce Lee. You know, you don't do just jiu-jitsu, or you don't do just karate. It's like you take all of these different styles,
yeah.
and some of them very unorthodox,
yeah.
and you throw them all in this huge, complicated mixing pot, stew, if you will, and you've made this interesting guitar sound that is unlike a lot of people that I've ever heard.
Well, it's the basis of it, the architecture. The architectural design of what I do is based on the style of Merle Travis and Chet Atkins and Jerry Reed and those kind of people. That's my kind of finger style. But then I add in elements of jazz and funk and rock and roll and blues and kind of mix them up, you know. And I listen to piano players a lot, and I try to steal as many ideas as I can from piano players who excite me, who do something different. And sometimes I just get a song going and I just fly around it and see what I can do with it. And I one of the most important things is not to let your you put yourself in a box.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
You got to be free. And so you got to think outside the box all the time. So, you know, I'll take a tune that I've been playing for a while, and then tonight I'll play it a lot slower.
Oh, wow.
Just to see what I can do with it.
Do you do that live, or do you do that before you?
No, I do it as on the show.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. And like every night, I don't write a set list. I don't plan the show. My biggest decision is what do I start with? Because it's important to start strong, you know, because you're going to walk out there and you know that probably more than half the people in that crowd have not seen you before.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to know that. And so you want to make a good impression right out of the gate.
Okay.
So you don't want to pick something that's way, you know, too fast or too difficult straight off, even if you're warmed up and ready to go. You want to go out there and play with precision, with feeling, with a good sound and all that sort of stuff, and make a connection with those people straight away in the first 30 seconds. And that's really important. From then on, you can do what you like.
So you're an audience reader.
I'm out there for the people.
So you base your whole set list is based off of the crowd reaction.
Yeah,
kind
well,
of figuring out where they go.
I take people with me. I know how to put a show together, and I have enough repertoire that if I want to take it a certain way, I can just go that way.
That's
you know,
very, that is
and
very cool.
Yeah, you can bend it and ply it and all that sort of stuff. You know, and people sing out for songs. You know, and I'll go straight into it. You know, I take requests and so, and I always tell people I only play requests when people ask. You know, and write them on the back of any old $20 note and all that stuff, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you're from Australia.
I am.
And so it's, I did a little bit of homework on biographical things. So you started playing when you were four?
I did, yeah. It was my mother who started me. She was already playing.
She played lap steel, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had discovered Hawaiian music in the late 50s.
Okay.
So I was born in 55. So 59, we were living in a little town called Gunnedah, and my father was working for the soil conservation. I started kindergarten, and the school was across the road from our house. So every day I'd go to school, and when the bell rang, my mother would be waiting with her lap steel and my little guitar in the lounge room, and I'd come running home, and her and I would sit and play until all the others, my elder brothers and sisters, came home. Uh-huh. And then Mum had to take care of everybody. And that was my daily routine as a four-year-old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and my mother showed me how a song is constructed and how to count the bars.
Who taught her?
She was taught by a guy named Harry Stibbard.
Okay.
Who, when my mum, during the Second World War, my mother lived with her parents, my grandparents. They ran a dairy farm, and across the river from them were the Stibbards, who had a dairy farm as well.
Okay.
And their son was very sweet on my mother, and gave her a guitar and showed her how to play it. And so she knew how to strum chords and how to sing. And when the war escalated in the Second World War, my mother would go up to the city of Brisbane and sing to the troops as they left on all the trains, one after the other. She'd sing Waltzing Matilda and We'll Meet Again and all those songs. And that's what she did. She was 15.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so she taught you, did she teach you structure? Did she teach you?
She taught me how to understand the structure of a song.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the chords to the first verse.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the second verse, and the chords are the same.
Oh,
So we'll call the verse A.
Okay.
So we've got A. Okay. That's two verses. Now the chorus goes like this. We'll call that B.
Okay.
Now after the chorus is the third verse, we'll call that A. And then there's another chorus, we'll call that B again. So after the second chorus, there's a solo,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a key change, and then we go out with the chorus. So here's the structure of this song. Introduction, A, B, A, B, 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 B.
So she kind of created her own... musical kind of structure.
So a kindergarten person could understand.
Right, I know, it's kind of genius.
Well, I still use the same thing. You know what, because I've never had any official training and I don't read music, I play everything by ear.
I don't read music either, but the fact that you've never had any training just blows my mind.
Well, I've been a listener all my life and I've been a sponge around, you know, better musicians, especially when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I love hearing how they put a song together and how it works,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
So what I learned when I was young is that every song has a pattern. And if you lock onto the pattern, mm-hmm. you can work it out in patterns. So, okay,
sure.
Let's take Yesterday by Paul McCartney.
Okay.
Okay, so yesterday all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. That's one pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And the second verse goes, suddenly I'm not half... Oh, it's the same. So there's pattern one.
Sure.
So you work that out. And then it goes, why she had to go on. That's a different pattern.
Okay.
You know? So it goes. You know, you just listen for the patterns. Work those patterns out, piece it together, and lo and behold, you have a song.
Are you a big Beatles fan?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
I met Paul last month.
How cool was that?
Oh, the coolest, yeah. And I met George before he died. I met him at a studio in London.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing on a record, and he had played a slide solo on this track for Bill Wyman and the Rhythm Kings. And Bill rang me and asked me to come and play on this record. And when I rang the buzzer at Snake Ranch Studios in Chelsea, the door opened and it was George Harrison. I nearly fainted, you know. And he'd played on it. And anyway, I got to meet Paul a couple of months ago in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I was able to meet him before the show, and he was so nice. He really was. And I had taught at his college. This is a kind of funny story, but I was living in England back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and I was playing the Trowbridge Folk Music Festival. It was a big festival over there. And I came off from my set, and there was a really well-dressed man standing at the side of the stage with his hands out with a business card in his hand,
uh-huh.
like this. And I recognized the logo, and I knew it was Paul McCartney's company, because
uh-huh.
his logo, PLM Productions or something like that, is the logo of a juggler,
okay.
like this, right? And anyway... I recognized it straight away, and I said, oh, you work for Mr. McCartney, do you? He said, yes, and I'm here to offer you a job. And I said, he wants me in the band? Hooray! You know. And he said, no, but he does want you to come and teach rock and roll guitar from the 50s and 60s at his institute in Liverpool. And I immediately, quick as a wink, I said, he couldn't possibly afford me. Like that, just joking, you know. And he kind of smiled. He probably heard that 1,000 times, and he just looked at me and said, oh, you can name your price.
Oh.
And I, you know, I thought about it for a second, but the road was calling me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, look, this is really great and I really appreciate the offer, but I can't commit to something like that because I'm a touring musician. That's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I travel around and play. I do live in Suffolk in those days, so it was on the other side of England.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I could drive 4 hours there, teach for 3 days and go back, and then I could play on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrestled with it for 30 seconds and then I said, sorry, but I could come and teach there and do a few master classes, but I couldn't be in residence.
Sure,
kind of thing.
Sure.
So I had to turn it down, but I did contact them, and I every time I was touring in England, I would go to Liverpool, mm-hmm. to the what we call LIPA, Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts.
Okay.
And in the Paul McCartney Concert Hall there, I would teach 300 students for 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
And it was great. What a wonderful institute it is. And he set it up. He funds it.
That's fantastic.
And when I met him, he told me that the building was his old school that he went to, and they were going to tear it down and make apartments and everything. And he just wanted to keep that building, so he bought that whole building, and then he bought the one next door, and then he set up the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts.
He could probably buy all of
them. Oh, he could. Yeah, he could buy, you know, Russia.
Right.
So,
right.
So you know, isn't that wonderful? And he thanked me for coming there and for teaching. And he said, "You've got to go where the heart is."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was exactly the words he used.
You've got to go.
That's what he told me. He said, "I did that because that's what I wanted to do." And mm-hmm. I'm glad that you want to be coming there to teach. You've got to go where your heart is.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you started playing in a band, I guess, when you were about 8.
A lot younger than that. The band was the Emmanuel Family Band, the Emmanuel Quartet, and I was the youngest. My eldest brother Chris played drums. My sister Virginia played steel guitar, like our mother, and my brother Phil, my closest sibling,
mm-hmm.
he was the lead guitar player. I was the rhythm player.
Okay.
And a funny thing happened when I was a kid. Listening to music, mostly records and off the radio, I was not aware that there was a bass guitar. I thought the rhythm player played the bass.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked out how to get that sound,
playing
the rhythm and then the bass notes, right?
That explains that.
Yeah. Okay. And then when I heard Chet Atkins, I said, oh, he's playing everything at once. And people were like, no, it's a recording trick. And I was like, no, I can hear that. You know,
mm-hmm.
he's definitely playing everything at once. And so that's what started me on that road, you know.
Chet Atkins, definitely number one.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh.
He was incredible.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So how did you meet Chet Atkins?
I wrote him a letter. My father died when I was 10. And I kind of went into the world of his records.
Really?
Wearing headphones and playing his records on this little turntable.
Uh-huh.
That's what got me through that period of grief over my losing my father.
Okay.
And
was it a heart attack or?
Yeah,
or
he just suddenly died.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, he'd had two pretty major heart attacks prior to that.
Mm.
He had an angina and he was a smoker, so he had no hope. You know.
Okay.
And he came back from the Second World War not in good shape. He'd been wounded, and he'd been wounded spiritually, I think, as well, you know. And my mother said he was not the same person, but she stuck with him, and I'm glad she did because I'm here, you know. After Dad died, I wrote this fan letter to Chet. And you know, I wrote on the envelope, this is 1967, all right, Chet Atkins, Nashville, America, and sent it off. He got it.
Really? That's all you put on there?
That's all I put on there. Because in those days, there were no zip codes and stuff like that.
Okay.
You know, it was probably delivered on horseback.
Anyway. Paul Revere took it.
That's right.
Oh, my goodness.
And so he wrote back to me and sent me a black and white photograph signed to me and a really nice letter.
It didn't say Tommy Emmanuel, Australia, did it?
No. It was it did, but it was my exact address.
I'm just being
funny. Yeah.
More of a simple time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, I was going to school. I was going to primary school at that time, or middle school, you call it here.
Mm-hmm.
We call it primary school.
Okay.
You know, you have kindergarten, primary school, high school, university,
okay,
that kind of thing. And Chet wrote to me, and I was so thrilled to get his letter and this photograph from my hero, you know. And about 10 years later, some friends of mine in Sydney recorded me playing in their lounge room. I was just sitting playing some tunes for them because they were big Chet nuts as well, you know. Mm-hmm. And they sent the tape to him without telling me. And I get this handwritten letter out of the blue from Chet saying, I heard you on a tape and you're playing really well and here's my office number. When you come to Nashville, call me.
Whoa.
Yeah, just out of the blue.
And you were 22.
Mm-hmm.
Was this before or after you wrote, because I'm trying to do the math and I'm not very mm-hmm. good at it, so forgive me, but was mm-hmm. this, you put out a record in 79?
Yeah.
So was this before that record or after that record?
It was about that time.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a song on that record called Dixie McGuire, which ended up on the album that I did with Chet.
Okay.
And I had just written that song a couple of years prior.
Oh, wow.
And I played it to him over the phone, and he loved it. And he said, yeah, we should do that. And, you know,
that's
so
very cool.
And, I was never sure about that song. Because when you're younger, you're not supremely confident, sure, you know, about sure. your own work. You're kind of trying to gauge it against things that you know are good. And anyway, a friend of mine who'd had a lot of hit records as a songwriter, I just said to him, can I play you something? And he said, yeah, yeah. So I played him the song Dixie McGuire, and I said, is it any good? And he said, oh, it's good, all right. And a good song will find a good home.
Ah.
And he was right.
Okay.
It found the right home.
So he sent you this letter. Send
me
the
letter.
Come to Nashville.
So in 1980,
okay,
I made the pilgrimage. I came to America for the first time. Sydney to LA. I saw Elton John at the Hollywood Bowl.
Very cool.
Went to a friend's wedding. Then I came to Nashville. And I checked into the Holiday Inn down there on West End. And I was in his town. I was so pumped. I couldn't stop playing my guitar. And my wife was going crazy. She said, I've got to get some sleep. We were jet lagged, you know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't. I was wired just being in Chet's town, you know. And eventually she kicked me out of the room and said, go somewhere else and play.
Did you go somewhere else?
I did. I went across the road to Centennial Park.
Okay.
And I found a sort of park bench, and I sat there playing my little nylon string guitar.
Did everybody start circling around you?
No. What happened was, this is about 3 a.m. The sun starts coming up, and joggers start going by, and squirrels are going up and down the tree. And next thing I know, it's breakfast time. I've played all night.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still wired. I'm still buzzed, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had to wait till 10 a.m. to call him, and it seemed like a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I, at about 2:02, I called, and he picked up the phone. And I said, I'm looking for Mr. Atkins. He said, this is he. And I said, it's Tommy Emmanuel from Australia, thinking he won't have a clue who that is. And, he says, hey, Tommy, I was just listening to your tape. Where are you? And I said, I'm down the road at the Holiday Inn. He said, well, come on down. I'll see you right now. So I race back and get the keys to the rental car, grab my guitar and get in the car and go up to Music Row. And Chet had his office on 16th Avenue South.
Mm-hmm.
And so I come into the reception area, and his receptionist, Caroline, I remember, she said, what do you want, son? Like this, you know, real southern drawl. And I said, I'm here to see Mr. Atkins, and he asked me to come down. And so she gets on the intercom
mm-hmm.
and says, there's a boy here from down under. And I can hear Chet say, is he a finger picker? And I says, I hold up my thumb with a thumb pick on it. Yeah, like this, you know. And she says, he says he is. Like that. He says, I'll be right down. Like that. So he comes down the stairs carrying one of his guitars, and he comes over to me, and he must have known how I was feeling because, you know, I was about to explode. I'm meeting my hero, you know. And he came over and he spoke really gently and put his arm on my shoulder and he said, you want to pick a little for me? I said, yeah. So he took me into a room side office and I start playing me and Bobby McGee.
Oh, wow.
Right. And he goes to join in and he just stops himself and folds his hands and watches me play for the first couple of times round. And then he joins in and it was just so perfect. He went straight to all the harmonies. He knew exactly what I was doing and we just fit like perfect, you know, because I learned it all from him, you know. He knew exactly what, and we sounded instantly like a guitar duo. You know, it was beautiful. And then I played a couple of other pieces for him and he said, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. And you know, he was pointing out all these things that he didn't do. So he was his way of telling me I was inventing my own stuff.
Yes.
I wasn't just copying him, you know. And then he asked me to play some of my original songs and I played some for him and he was really complimentary and said, maybe that chord, you should try this chord and that kind of stuff. Then he said, I'd like you to come upstairs and meet the greatest guitar player walking the earth.
Really?
And I said, yeah, who, you know, I had a feeling I knew who it was.
You did?
Yeah. And as we were going up the stairs to the third level, I could hear the guitar playing and I knew exactly who it was. It was a guy named Lenny Bro. And I had Lenny's albums.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He was discovered by and signed by Chet to RCA. And his first two albums were just mind-blowing guitar playing. It was, he played, it was jazz, but he played like Bill Evans used to play the piano.
Okay.
His style was based on that. And a complete independence and freedom of expression, you know. And anyway, so we come into the top room on the third level. And Chet says, hey, this is Tommy from Australia. And we shake hands and bang, we just start playing, you know.
Really?
And the three of us sat around a table, just like you and I are now, and played tune after tune after. And Chet played some solos that you wouldn't believe. He did stuff that I never heard him do that day. It was mind-blowing. And every now and again, he'd have to, because he was still the A&R director of RCA Records, so he had to take calls. So he'd just jump out of the circle, take the call, and then just jump right back in the middle of whatever, you know.
That is so cool.
And it was backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And then he took me aside and said, would you take Lenny to where he's playing tonight and take care of him? And I said, sure. So Lenny was a drug addict. He was in bad shape,
okay,
which was a shame. And
heroin?
Yeah, all anything.
Anything you get.
He was just was just a druggie.
And he
knew it. You know, if he came to your house, he'd go through your medical cabinet. You know what I mean? And take 10 of whatever was there. That's what he was like. Yeah. And but what a beautiful spirit he was. Unfortunately, he met his demise in 1984. Somebody strangled him and put him in a swimming pool. And,
oh no.
Yeah. But anyway, I took him to his show that night where he was playing at a club here in Nashville.
Remember the name of the club?
I went in there and set up. He didn't even have a guitar or an amp. He had nothing. And Chet loaned him his guitar and amp.
Mm-hmm.
And I set it up and tuned his guitar for him. And he got up and played with a band. And it was deep and just musicianship and ideas on a level that I had never experienced before. And it just seemed like the more tequila he drank, the deeper it got. And
really?
It was really strange, yeah. But it really, truly, I witnessed something great that night.
Was it like one of those, what was the guy that, the legendary guitar player that was at the black guy that sold his soul to the devil.
Oh, you mean Robert Johnson?
Yeah, was it something like that?
It was far, far... Well, it was different. You can't really compare. But you're right. I know what you mean. It was like supernatural.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. It was like, I've never heard anybody go that deep, you know, on the instrument. It was phenomenal. And
do you remember the name of the club that was?
No.
Okay.
No, it reminded me of the Bluebird, but it was a different...
Okay.
It was the bar was much bigger.
Okay.
It was a bar that had a band playing in it.
That's cool.
And I didn't really go to bars. If I wanted to have a drink, I'd have a drink at home. You know, I've never been a guy who goes out to bars and stuff.
Right.
I've never been interested. Anyway, So that was my trip in 1980. I came here to Nashville, and a seed was planted there on that trip. You know, Chet said, I believe you're going to end up here, and this is where you belong. Mm-hmm. And he said that to me.
Right.
Fast forward 14 years, and I came here and did a country music showcase for Sony. I was signed with Sony. Chet and I were both on Columbia. And there was Sony brought a whole bunch of Australian artists out here, and we did two nights at the Ace of Clubs in town.
So, in truthfulness, you were Keith Urban before Keith Urban.
Well, no, Keith is a good singer. I've known Keith since he was a boy. And
really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he used to come and sit in. He used to come to my shows when he was a teenager, you know, with pink hair and black fingernails and wondering who the hell he was, you know. And he'd come to my shows and he'd send me flowers backstage and he'd come and hang out. He was really... interesting guy. He's still the same.
He is, sweetheart.
Oh, he is. Yeah, him and I had an interesting conversation on a flight in Australia after a show. He'd been at my show, and we were both flying back from Brisbane to Sydney. And he was about 16, I think, at that time. And we got talking, and he said, "You know, I really want to get somewhere in this business, and how do I get going, kind of thing, you know." Mm-hmm. And I said to him, where do you see yourself? What's your vision mm-hmm. of where you belong? He said, I want to be a stadium player. I said, okay, if you want to be a stadium player, then you're going to have a lot of hits, because stadiums are big, mm-hmm. and the only way you're going to fill that stadium is with hit records, where everybody wants to come and see you. So the first thing you got to do is get the hell out of here, meaning Australia,
sure.
and go to America and start writing songs. And that's exactly what he did.
Oh, wow. So you're the guy that sent him.
No, I'm sure there were other people who told him the same thing. But he was doing pretty well in Australia, but this is where the fire really took off, you know?
The reason I gave you that credit is because, I mean, if he had pink hair and black fingernail polish and stuff like that...
Well, that was that week.
He could have very well ended up in L.A. or New York or whatever else, but he came to Nashville.
Yeah, but I mean, he spent time in L.A. too. Okay. We all did.
Okay.
You know, I think... he's evolved in such a beautiful way as an artist. And his records and his writing, his singing, his playing, everything about what he does has integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows exactly who he is. And that's the great thing. He's a master of his own ship. Yet he'll be the first to say, you know, I'm so grateful for what the universe has given me.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be the first to tell you that.
Wow.
Yeah. He's a great encourager. When I won the CMA Award of Global Country Artist of the Year in 2010, nobody was more surprised than I was. But I think it was at that period I was touring so much, and I think the Country Music Association saw that I traveled more than any other artist that came from Nashville, was a kind of ambassador for this place, for the music that came from here and all that, without even really thinking about it that way.
Sure.
And so I was really honored when they gave me that award. And they presented it to me downtown on Broadway. And we were in this kind of honky-tonk. It was jammed with people. And all of a sudden... Keith jumps up on stage out of the crowd
and
makes a speech and gives me the award. And it was like our lives came full circle.
Absolutely.
You know?
How cool is that?
Oh yeah, it was wonderful.
Oh man. So have you come up, you know, like you made a great impact on him, on Keith, when he was very, very young and inspired him to chase that dream, kind mm-hmm. of like Chet did for you.
Exactly.
Have you done that with any other that you can think of right off the top of your head?
Every young artist I ever come across.
Oh, wow.
Everybody.
Wow.
Sure. I mean, there's been so many people. There have been some artists. For instance, there's a young man named Anthony Snape who I heard one of his songs, and I instantly said, oh my God, did he write that song? They said, yeah. I said, let's get him over here. He was from my hometown.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Where I started playing guitar when I was 4 years old, he lived and grew up around the corner from that same town. And
so Anthony Snape?
Snape, yeah.
Snape. So this is a name for my listeners out there. Listen, go look for Anthony Snape. Go Google him. Mm. That's your future Keith Urban out there right there. Get on the bandwagon before he's the big thing.
He's writing great songs, and he's a great Australian, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. And I had him on tour with me a lot of times. And there's an album of mine called Little by Little, mm-hmm. and Anthony sings a couple of verses of a song with me, and he helped me with all the backing vocals and all that stuff. In fact, years ago, Keith used to come in and sing on people's demos and play guitar on them for free, just to have
the
experience and something to do, you know.
Yeah.
And I can remember when I was living out of Chet Atkins' house back in the late 90s, I was living in the little granny flat beside his house. Keith used to come along in his old Chev, pick me up, and we'd go out and have a few beers and see some music and hang out, you know.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
So did y'all, the three of y'all ever pick together?
No. But I played a few times at a place called Cafe Milano,
okay.
which no longer exists, but it was owned by the Gibson Guitar Company.
Okay.
And Chet played there a lot, and I ended up getting Monday nights for a while. And Keith used to always come down. You can see on YouTube, there's some footage of Keith and I jamming at Cafe Milano back in, whenever it was, back in 98 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Back when I had hair and teeth, you know.
You still have hair and teeth. What are you talking about, man? You look like you're 45 years old.
Oh,
easy, thanks. Easy. I mean, you definitely look like you're my age, and I'm 46. So
I'm
living hard,
I'm 61.
Or you're really good.
Well, I'm happy, and that's all that matters.
You're happy. Yeah. So you have young children, right?
I do. I have an 18-month-old daughter.
Okay.
And my wife and I. We got married about 5 years ago.
Okay.
So I was married prior to that, and I have two children by that marriage.
Uh-huh.
And they're in England.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a song of mine that kind of everybody associates with me called Angelina.
Uh-huh.
And Angelina is my teenage daughter. She's 17 now.
Mm-hmm.
But I have another daughter who was born in Sydney. I actually have three daughters. Amanda, who was born in Sydney.
Okay.
So she's an Aussie, but she married an English guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have Angelina, who was born in England. And I have Rachel, who was born here in Nashville.
Uh-huh.
So three daughters, three countries, three continents.
Oh, that's cool. You're a world traveler.
Yeah.
So I have an 18-year-old boy. He'll be 18 next week.
Uh-huh.
I have a daughter that'll be 6 next week.
Wow.
And I have a 2-year-old that'll be 3 in January. So I started over too, yourself. And,
yeah.
And I have some young ones myself. So they keep us on our toes.
They do, yeah.
Keep us young, for sure.
Just great. She's the light of my life. She really is, you know.
So how did the whole, you know, you have the incredible story of being on Chet's last record. Was it his record or your record?
It was the both of us. Yeah, yeah. Well, that came about after I did the showcase here at the Ace of Clubs.
Okay.
Chet had come down to see me play because he'd never seen me do a show. We'd only jammed a bit.
Okay.
You know, he'd never actually seen me perform what I do, you know. And so I think he was suitably impressed with my show and the response from the crowd and everything. And so the next night, he brought all the record company people down. He went and rounded them up and made sure that they come to see me play. And they were just blown away. And they all came back after the show and, you know, wanted to buy me drinks and take me out and all that. And I said, well, I've got to be up early. I've got to be back in Australia and all that. So I left and didn't think any more about it. And about a week later, the phone rings and it's Chet. And he says, well, these Columbia people are really excited about you. And they think we should work together. And And he said, would you like to do that? And I said, is there a mustache in Mexico? And so we start talking about recording, you know, and I just can't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I put the phone down and I wrote a song called Mr. Guitar,
mm-hmm.
which is Chet's moniker. It was his nickname.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote the song in 10 minutes
mm-hmm.
and I rang him back and I played it to him over the phone. He loved it. And that was the first song. Then I played him Dixie McGuire, the song I wrote in the 70s. He liked that. So I had two songs in there already, you know. So we were, yeah, so we were off and running. And then we started sending tapes to each other
mm-hmm.
with ideas and started to write via mail,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then we eventually locked in a period of time where I could come over here and we could start work on the album.
Mm-hmm.
Chet was dealing with some cancer and all that sort of stuff, so he was kind of in and out of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to take the helm of the project.
Sure.
And I hired a young man who was a programmer who was good at all that sort of stuff. So I mapped out the songs, and I had the programmer put a click track down, and then we put bass drum, snare drum, hi-hats and all that, and put those down. And then I put a rhythm part and then a guide bass. And then I laid down all my lead parts. And then while Chet was not feeling good, I put down his parts
mm-hmm.
and I kind of did a roadmap for him and said, this is where you play, your part is on the tape.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all you got to learn, that part there and everything. And then I just, when it was his turn to take a solo, I would just write Chet solo on that part and he would just improvise a solo.
Mm-hmm.
Before I left, we cut three tracks together because we couldn't do them separately. They were just two guitars just sitting playing.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to get those done. The rest of the album I pieced together and then left it for him for when he was well enough to put his part on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back to mix it after my Australian tour. I flew back here to Nashville and I got in late at night. And I went into my room where I stayed, and his guitar, his guitar is called a Del Vecchio, a resonator guitar made in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of one of his signature guitars. And his guitar was on the bed with his microphone and a note. And it said, I'm in the Baptist Hospital under C.B. Burton. I've done the best I can with all this. But if I've missed anything, please fix it up. Please, mm-hmm. you know, either finish it or whatever. So I had to take his guitar and his mic.
Mm-hmm.
So if I needed to do something, I'd have to repair his part.
Sure. Did you need to fix anything?
No. But there were some parts he forgot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can understand that he had a brain tumor.
Sure, sure.
So, yeah, the harmonies on the second track on the album, it sounds like him, but it's actually me playing.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, some of his solos were so wonderful. They really were.
He was just a freaking phenomenal guitar
player. Oh, yeah, he was. He had a great tone, a great touch. And so I did that, and then I got Chuck Ainley, who worked for Mark Knopfler in those days. Chuck was here. I got him to mix the album with okay. me, and he did a beautiful job on it. And Chet got really well for a while, and the album came out. We got a Grammy nomination. We won the Nashville Music Awards for Best Instrumental,
mm-hmm.
and we were off. You know, and it was really a relaunch for him, and a chance to introduce me to the American public
right.
with him. And unfortunately, his tumor came back, and they had to operate on him and give him radiation, and it killed his motor skills, and he couldn't play anymore.
Yeah.
And so all the plans that we had, we were going to be on the Letterman and Leno and all the shows, all the daytime shows. We were going to be, you know, he was going to be relaunching his own career sure. again, and I was privileged to be a part of that. But we had to cancel everything because,
right.
And then he just went downhill from there. And he passed away in 2001.
Okay.
So it's been 15 years as of the 29th of June.
Okay.
Just this past June.
You sat there playing the festival that they do every year.
Yeah. We just had the annual Chet Atkins Appreciation Society convention.
Okay.
And it's always a beautiful event, you know. And some of his relations were there and his friends and family and all that. And yeah, we did a tribute to him, that's for sure.
And that happens every year?
Every year in July.
How many years has it gone on? 15 or 16?
26.
26? Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. It's been a real joy to be involved in that, because you just go there and play his songs.
Sure.
You know, and there's the music you grew up with, and it just feels so good to play it, yeah. You know. And you know, every year the older folks are getting older,
mm-hmm.
and they're just hungry to hear that music one more time.
Yeah.
You know?
I can see that, for sure.
And there's no money involved, there's no anything. It's just for the love of Chet and his music. That's why we all get together.
Wow.
And there's jamming, and there's workshops. And there are guys who can teach you note for note how Chet played, you know, Mr. Sandman in 1957 or whatever. They can play it exactly and show you all the phrases and how it works. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. And there are some guys who specialize in, you know, from 1962 to 65,
uh-huh.
all that, you know. His disciples are all here.
So your passport must look like a stamp collection.
I've got two passports.
Oh, my goodness.
Two Australian passports, yeah.
I bet.
You have to, because when you go to China or Russia,
mm-hmm.
which I do nearly every year, you have to send your passport in to get your visa.
What?
They don't want to see you. They don't want to talk to you. They want the company that they deal with to send in the passport. They approve it. Stamp it, send it back to the company, and then you get your passport back.
So that's why you have two passports.
That's why, because I still need to be traveling.
Right, right. So how many dates a year do you do?
About 300.
300?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm. So I'm trying to get good at this. what else are you going to do?
You obviously don't go one place and do five dates in one place, right?
Only occasionally.
Okay.
Like I'll do three nights at BB King's in New York.
Okay.
And then a year later I'll come back and just play one night at the New York Town Hall in Manhattan.
Okay.
So I kind of mix it up.
Okay.
When I go to LA, I'll play at the El Rey downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll play two shows at the Pepperdine University, because they have a smaller hall, about 700 seats. So I play two nights there.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe I'll do the House of Blues. So I'll be in L.A. area for, you know, then I'll go down to Orange County and San Diego, then up to San Francisco, and you know. So
You're just all over.
Yeah, well, that America is so big, you know, and I'm just so grateful to be here. America has been wonderful to me. I received the Immigrant Achievement Award a few years ago, and it was so moving to me because I felt so welcome, you know.
That's
and it's
awesome.
It's a really wonderful thing. And, you know, it's not just my Chet connection, mm-hmm. but, you know, I have friends everywhere here, mm-hmm. and the guitar does that for you.
Sure.
It'll
sure.
take you everywhere. You
sure,
know.
Absolutely. It'll introduce you. It'll walk you in doors that you probably couldn't have got in otherwise.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about anybody, really.
Yeah,
music does that for people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I've been on the Opry a lot, and I've enjoyed being on WSM and on Lightning 100 and all the good stations, you know. And whenever I'm in town, I just try to get around and say hello to people and, you know, call into guitar stores and sit and play and hang out with people, because that's what I love to do.
Sure, you know? Sure. When you step out on that Opry stage, is there something
magical
awesome. About it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, man.
You know, and the Opry is like, you know, you get three songs,
mm-hmm.
and you wait hours for those three songs. So, and you usually play better in the dressing room than you do in, because when you get out there, you're like losing your mind
with
the big crowd and the big stage, and then you look down at this stage that you're standing on, and think about all the people who have been on there.
Sure.
It's incredible.
Sure.
Playing the Ryman is wonderful.
Oh,
I played my show at the Ryman this year in February. And then I did the Dylan Fest.
Oh, wow.
And I got to play Nashville Skyline Rag. And Charlie McCoy stood right beside me and played harmonica. The guy who played on the original, you know.
It was nuts.
Oh, it was great.
I don't know. It just would be so surreal.
Yeah.
I think I would lose I think I would lose my mind. I might just freeze up and go like, what?
Well, you got to savor the moment, you know.
Sure.
You got to try and take it all in. Because, you know, all you have is now.
Right.
You know? And you can't go back to how it used to be, and you don't know what's going to happen. So you got to be in the now,
right.
You know.
So you've recorded 30
something
records, 30 something records,
something like that.
Okay,
yeah.
So you just put out two more.
Yeah, and there's a new Christmas album coming in November, and a Christmas tour, and I'm three quarters away completing a new duets album with various Nashville artists.
Oh.
Yeah, so I've got a song with Rodney Crowell on my album, two songs with Ricky Skaggs. And this week, I did Tuesday, I was in the studio with Jerry Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
And Wednesday, I did six songs with David Grisman and Brian Sutton.
Wow.
And
you need to call Keith Urban.
Yeah, well, I did. Keith was the first one I called, and he was just about to go into promotion and touring for his new album.
Okay.
And he said, I'm up to my eyeballs in everything. I got no time right now, but let's look at next year.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
He's a great guy. You know, when you're at that level, his time is precious.
Oh, yes. I mean, he did American Idol. Everything else just blew up for him.
Yeah.
That even took it to a whole nother level. He was as big as it could possibly be in country music, then got on American Idol, and then it made him just, like, that twice as big.
Yeah.
It's like, how?
And how good is his new album? It's unbelievable.
He is a phenomenal artist himself.
He sure is.
For sure. And he can sing very, very well.
Yeah. And he plays great, and he writes great.
So tell us where everybody can go out to find Tommy Emmanuel.
Okay. Well, if you go to TommyEmmanuel.com, if you want to know where I'm playing, just push on tours.
Okay.
If you want to contact me, you can contact me through there. It says make contact.
Okay.
Or you can go to Facebook, and I have two fan pages under my name, and I have a personal one as well.
Okay.
So I have three pages on Facebook, and my management is ABI Management in Nashville.
Okay.
And my agents are High Road. So there you go.
So what is your Twitter handle?
I have no idea.
You don't have any? Oh,
I do, but I have no idea. I got people.
You just big time me. Oh my God.
You asked.
All right. So as we close up the show, would you tell the listeners, dream big, everybody.
Dream big, everybody.
Dream big.
All right.
Oh my God. I got people.
Life is not a rehearsal, so get on with it. All right, I better get back to my girls.
All right.
That was fun.